Robert Moses stands as the most influential unelected official in American history, a man who transformed New York's landscape with unparalleled vision and ruthless determination. For over four decades, he wielded more power than mayors, governors, or even presidents, building 627 miles of roads, 658 playgrounds, 13 bridges, and reshaping an area inhabited by 12 million people. Though he never learned to drive, Moses created the modern American city's automobile-centered paradigm. His story represents the eternal question of power, its uses, abuses, and the price we pay for progress. Named America's greatest builder by the New York Times and celebrated by President Roosevelt as a visionary who gets things done, Moses remains a deeply controversial figure. His projects include beloved landmarks like Jones Beach, the Triborough Bridge, and Lincoln Center, yet his methods displaced hundreds of thousands of people, primarily poor minorities, and prioritized highways over public transportation in ways that continue to shape our cities today. The Power Broker isn't just Moses' story. It's the story of how modern urban America was built, for better or worse. Robert Moses was born in 1888 to wealthy Jewish parents, growing up amid privilege in New Haven, Connecticut, and later Manhattan. His mother, Bella, a strong-willed, imperious woman, instilled in him both passionate idealism and overwhelming arrogance, traits that would define his career. At Yale, Moses showed early signs of his complex character. Though initially shy and bookish, he organized the Minor Sports Association to secure funding for non-football sports, displaying both his organizational genius and ethical flexibility when he proposed misleading donors about how their money would be used. After Yale, Moses studied at Oxford, where he found his spiritual home among Britain's educated elite. The experience transformed his vague desire to help people into a clear concept of public service, while simultaneously reinforcing his belief in the natural superiority of the educated class. He developed a profound admiration for the British civil service system, with its rigid class differentiation between university-educated administrators and ordinary clerks, a system he would later try to replicate in America. Returning to New York, Moses joined the Bureau of Municipal Research, a progressive organization dedicated to making government more efficient. Here, he displayed both his brilliant analytical mind and his growing impatience with democratic processes. While walking along Riverside Drive with his future wife, Mary Sims, Moses would gaze at the decrepit waterfront and envision the most beautiful thing in the world. Parks, highways, and recreational facilities replacing the ugly railroad tracks that cut off the city from its shoreline. These dreams would later become reality, but first, Moses needed power. His opportunity came in 1919 when Governor Al Smith appointed him to the State Reconstruction Commission. Working closely with Smith's advisor, Bell Moskowitz, Moses learned crucial political lessons. When he proposed idealistic reforms, Bell would evaluate their political feasibility, teaching him that government wasn't just about having the right ideas, but about getting them implemented. Moses was very theoretical, always wanting to do exactly what was right, one staffer recalled. She was more practical. She wanted to concentrate on what was possible. Moses' true rise to power began in 1924 when Governor Smith appointed him president of the Long Island State Park Commission. Through carefully drafted legislation that few bothered to read closely, Moses secured unprecedented powers, including the ability to immediately seize property through appropriation without prior negotiation. When wealthy Long Island estate owners discovered surveyors marking paths across their manicured lawns, they were outraged, but Moses was just getting started. His first major confrontation came with the Taylor estate, where he seized property for a park despite lacking sufficient funds. When courts ruled against him, Moses simply ignored them. Governor Smith backed Moses completely, reframing the legal battle as the few against the many, privileged millionaires versus ordinary citizens seeking recreation. This pattern would repeat throughout Moses' career. He would identify a goal, pursue it with single-minded determination, and overcome opposition through a combination of legal maneuvering, political support, and sheer force of will. Jones Beach represents Moses' most beloved achievement. Where others saw a desolate sandbar, Moses envisioned a bathing beach such as America had never seen. He transformed this barrier island into an architectural masterpiece with elegant bathhouses, meticulous landscaping, and charming nautical details. The project required Herculean engineering efforts, moving 40 million cubic yards of sand to raise the beach level, planting millions of beach grass clumps by hand to prevent erosion, and building the Wantagh Causeway to provide access. When Jones Beach opened in August 1929, the public was awestruck. Within a month, 325,000 visitors had crossed the causeway, and newspapers proclaimed it the finest seashore playground ever given the public anywhere in the world. Yet even in this triumph lay the seeds of controversy. Moses deliberately designed Jones Beach to be accessible only by automobile, with bridges too low for buses to pass underneath. When questioned about public transportation access, Moses dismissed the idea, ensuring that his magnificent creation would remain primarily available to middle and upper-class white families with cars, while excluding poor and minority New Yorkers who relied on public transit. When Fiorello LaGuardia became mayor of New York in 1934, he appointed Moses as the city's parks commissioner. Moses immediately demonstrated both his genius for organization and his ruthlessness. On his first day, he fired all five borough park commissioners and their top staff as of now. He circumvented civil service protections by reassigning employees to inconvenient locations or impossible tasks until they quit. For the Civil Works Administration, 68,000 relief workers, he demanded the right to hire skilled professionals regardless of their relief status and to pay them higher wages, threatening resignation when initially refused. The results were spectacular. In just a few months, Moses transformed the city's decrepit parks. By May 1, 1934, New Yorkers discovered their parks completely renovated. Every structure repainted, every tennis court resurfaced, every lawn reseeded. Moses had planted 11,000 new trees, pruned 62,000 others, and created vibrant flower beds where barren plots had been. The Central Park Zoo, once a disgraceful menagerie with animals in rotting wooden cages, became a picture book zoo with modern facilities. Moses opened 52 new playgrounds in his first year alone, increasing the city's total by 50%. The press and public were ecstatic. All 13 daily newspapers, regardless of political leaning, showered Moses with praise: dynamic, brilliant, tireless, fearless, and incorruptible. The Times declared his appointment a red-letter day in the history of New York and described his achievements as little short of miraculous. Children at park openings would chant, 2, 4, 6, 8, who do we appreciate? Mr. Moses! Mr. Moses! Mr. Moses! Moses' most ambitious project was the Triborough Bridge, a massive traffic machine linking three boroughs through four interconnected bridges and miles of viaducts. The project's scale was staggering. Enough concrete to pave a highway from New York to Philadelphia, enough steel to reopen 50 Pennsylvania mills, and enough lumber to clear an entire Pacific Coast forest. Beyond its size, Triborough's significance was immense. It would tie together three boroughs as large as cities themselves, reuniting Long Island with the mainland and eliminating countless hours of needless travel for New Yorkers. As Moses accumulated more positions, eventually holding 12 simultaneous titles, his methods grew increasingly autocratic. He discovered that public authorities, like the Triborough Bridge Authority, could generate revenue through tolls, creating an independent power base beyond the control of elected officials. By carefully structuring bond resolutions and embedding his powers in contracts protected by the U.S. Constitution, Moses created what one observer called a government within a government, an empire that no mayor or governor could dismantle. Moses used this power to reshape New York according to his vision, often with devastating consequences for existing communities. The Cross Bronx Expressway sliced through the heart of East Tremont, a stable, middle-class Jewish neighborhood. When residents discovered an alternative route that would have displaced only 19 families instead of 1,530, Moses refused to consider it. As construction dragged on for years, the neighborhood was destroyed, buildings abandoned, services cut off, and crime rising as middle-class families fled. By the time the expressway was completed, East Tremont had transformed from a vibrant community into an urban wasteland. This pattern repeated across the city. Moses' Title I urban renewal projects displaced tens of thousands of families, predominantly poor minorities, with inadequate relocation assistance. A City Planning Commission study revealed that for more than a third of displaced families, their status was marked disappeared, whereabouts unknown. When confronted with the human cost of his projects, Moses was unmoved. "You can't make an omelet without breaking eggs," he would say. In one speech, he declared his philosophy plainly. "When you operate in an overbuilt metropolis, you have to hack your way with a meat axe." Moses' transportation policies had equally profound consequences. He systematically undermined mass transit while building highways that quickly became congested. When airport planner F. Dodd McHugh proposed a subway connection to Idlewild, later JFK Airport, Moses eliminated it from the final plan. Instead, he built the Van Wyck Expressway, which became gridlocked almost immediately after opening. Moses refused to include provisions for future rapid transit lines on the Long Island Expressway, ensuring that Long Island would be forever dependent on automobiles. As transportation analyst Jack Sheridan later concluded, "Because of the highway, because of the pattern of high highway use developed by the lack of mass transit before, we're faced with this problem now, and right now we just can't get around it." Moses' power seemed unassailable until 1956, when a small protest over a parking lot expansion at Tavern on the Green in Central Park unexpectedly snowballed into a public relations disaster. What began with a few mothers pushing baby carriages grew into front-page news, with celebrities joining the cause. The controversy exposed Moses' questionable financial arrangements with the tavern's concessionaire and forced him to back down for the first time in decades. As one insider noted, he was never the same after that. More challenges followed. In 1959, Moses tried to force Joseph Papp's Free Shakespeare in the Park to charge admission. When Papp went public, the backlash was immediate and widespread. Editorials condemned Moses, Eleanor Roosevelt joined the criticism, and the courts ultimately ruled against him. That same year, investigative journalists began exposing the human cost of Moses' urban renewal projects, revealing how families were displaced without adequate relocation assistance. Moses sought to restore his reputation through the 1964-65 World's Fair, but the event became another disaster. His financial projections proved wildly optimistic, and by December 1964, outside auditors delivered devastating news. Contrary to Moses' claimed $12.7 million surplus, the fair had a $14 million deficit. "As of today, Mr. Moses," the auditor concluded, "we're insolvent." The fair ultimately lost $10 million, with investors receiving only 33 cents on the dollar. Moses' final defeat came at the hands of Governor Nelson Rockefeller in 1968. After decades of accumulating power, Moses lost control of his authorities when Rockefeller created the Metropolitan Transportation Authority to absorb the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority. Though Moses was offered a $25,000 consultant position with a car, chauffeurs, and secretaries, he had lost all actual power. On March 1, 1968, after 44 years in power, Moses issued a one-sentence statement accepting the advisory post, ending the age of Moses that had begun on April 23, 1924. In his final years, Moses grew increasingly bitter and resentful about what he perceived as public ingratitude. At the dedication of a marble bench in Flushing Meadows Park, he turned to a high church official and said over the public address system, "Someday, let us sit on this bench and reflect on the gratitude of man." This moment crystallized his late-life disillusionment. His name, once synonymous with progress and achievement, had become associated with urban problems, traffic congestion, declining public transportation, and neighborhood destruction. The man who had once commanded newspaper headlines now found himself increasingly marginalized in public discourse. Yet Moses' legacy is far more complex than either his admirers or critics acknowledge. He built recreational facilities that have brought joy to millions. Jones Beach alone has welcomed over 1 billion visitors since its creation, serving as a democratic playground where working-class families could escape the city's heat. His parks, playgrounds, and swimming pools provided desperately needed recreation space in a crowded city, with facilities like the Astoria Pool hosting Olympic trials and serving generations of New Yorkers. The bridges and highways he constructed, whatever their social costs, remain essential components of New York's infrastructure. The Triborough Bridge, the Verrazano Narrows Bridge, and the Brooklyn-Queens Expressway fundamentally altered how New Yorkers move through their city. Perhaps Moses' most important legacy is what he revealed about power in a democracy. He demonstrated how an unelected official could accumulate and wield authority that no elected representative could match, building a network of influence through public authorities that controlled vast financial resources. He showed how public authorities, ostensibly created to efficiently deliver public works, could become insulated fiefdoms beyond democratic control, answering neither to voters nor elected officials. His mastery of bond financing and legal structures created a template for public authorities nationwide. And he illustrated the tension between getting things done and respecting the rights and wishes of those affected by those things, a conflict that continues to challenge urban planners today. Robert Moses died in 1981 at age 92, outliving most of his contemporaries and critics. In his last years, he was largely forgotten by the public that had once celebrated him as a hero, spending his days in relative isolation at his Manhattan apartment and his house in Gilgo Beach. Yet his influence remains inescapable for anyone who drives on New York's highways, swims at its beaches, or visits its parks. The 416 miles of parkways he built, the 658 playgrounds he created, and the 13 bridges he constructed continue to shape daily life in New York. His story serves as both inspiration and warning, a testament to what one determined individual can accomplish, and a reminder of the human cost when that determination becomes detached from the very people it claims to serve. The power broker may have lost his direct influence, but his physical legacy continues to define New York's urban landscape, for better or worse. Moses' fundamental flaw wasn't lack of vision, but rather a vision too narrowly focused on physical structures at the expense of human communities. He could conceptualize magnificent bridges spanning mighty rivers, but couldn't understand the social fabric of neighborhoods his projects destroyed. This blind spot grew worse as his power increased, and he became increasingly isolated from ordinary citizens' experiences, retreating into a world of blueprints and political deal-making rather than community engagement. Moses never drove a car himself, experiencing his roads only from the back seat of a chauffeured limousine, where traffic jams were merely office time. He didn't ride the deteriorating subways whose funding he diverted to highways, nor did he witness the crushing overcrowding on platforms or the failing infrastructure in outer borough stations. He didn't struggle to find affordable housing after being displaced by his urban renewal projects, which forced over 250,000 New Yorkers from their homes. His Cross Bronx Expressway alone displaced 60,000 residents, primarily working-class families who had built stable communities over generations. This disconnect between Moses' grand designs and everyday realities produced increasingly dysfunctional outcomes as his career progressed. The irony of Moses' career is that his early projects succeeded precisely because he understood their human dimension. Jones Beach worked brilliantly because Moses thought carefully about visitors' experiences, from the nautical-themed water fountains to the meticulously maintained cleanliness. He insisted on details like positioning parking lots behind dunes to preserve the beach's natural beauty, and designing comfort stations that complemented the shoreline architecture. His early playgrounds showed similar attention to how people would actually use them, incorporating innovative features like splash pools and age-appropriate play zones. But as his empire expanded, Moses grew more concerned with building monuments than serving communities. His later projects prioritized efficient vehicle movement over neighborhood preservation and massive scale over human accessibility. The Triborough Bridge Complex, while an engineering marvel, created concrete barriers between communities that had once been naturally connected. His preference for highways over public transit reflected a fundamental misunderstanding of urban mobility needs, particularly for lower-income residents. The resulting car-centric infrastructure would shape, and in many cases damage, New York's development patterns for generations to come. Moses represents a fundamental paradox of democratic governance: how to balance efficiency with representation, expertise with accountability. Democracy is inherently messy and slow, with compromises and consultations that can delay or water down bold initiatives. Public hearings, environmental impact studies, community board reviews, and legislative oversight, while essential for democratic legitimacy, can add years to project timelines and millions to budgets. Moses offered an alternative: decisive action without the constraints of public opinion or legislative oversight. His authorities could issue bonds, condemn property, and build massive projects with minimal interference from elected officials, operating with the speed and decisiveness of a private corporation rather than a government agency. This approach delivered results that democratic processes might never have achieved. The tangled jurisdictions and competing interests of New York's governance would likely have prevented projects like the Triborough Bridge from ever being completed. Consider the bridge's complexity. It required coordination between three boroughs, multiple neighborhoods, various transportation authorities, and countless property owners. Moses cut through this Gordian knot with his authorities and his sheer force of will, completing the bridge in just 4 years. Similar projects today, subject to full democratic processes, often take decades. Yet the price was steep, not just in displaced communities and environmental damage, but in the erosion of democratic principles themselves. The Cross Bronx Expressway, for instance, displaced 60,000 residents with virtually no public consultation, permanently scarring entire neighborhoods. Moses's career raises uncomfortable questions that remain relevant today. How much power should unelected experts have in a democracy? When should efficiency trump participation? Who should decide how cities develop, technical specialists or the people who live in them? Modern examples abound, from high-speed rail projects to urban renewal initiatives, where these tensions between expertise and democracy continue to play out. The rise of smart cities and technocratic urban planning has renewed these debates for the digital age. There are no easy answers, but Moses's story suggests that when power becomes too concentrated and too insulated from public accountability, even the most brilliant vision can become distorted. His legacy serves as both a testament to the potential of decisive leadership and a warning about the dangers of unchecked authority in democratic societies. The challenge he presents remains: finding ways to execute ambitious public works while maintaining democratic legitimacy and protecting community interests. Contemporary cities like Barcelona and Copenhagen have attempted to thread this needle through participatory planning approaches that combine technical expertise with meaningful public engagement, suggesting possible alternatives to the Moses model. In the end, Robert Moses was both a singular individual and a product of his time and place. His personal qualities, brilliance, determination, arrogance, ruthlessness, shaped his career in unique ways. Yet he also exploited structural opportunities that American governance provided: the public authority system, the federal highway program, urban renewal legislation, and the mid-century faith in technical expertise. His ability to navigate these systems while maintaining absolute control over his projects demonstrated both his political acumen and his understanding of institutional power dynamics. Moses' genius lay in recognizing these opportunities and leveraging them more effectively than anyone else. Where others saw limitations, he found loopholes. Where others accepted constraints, he rewrote the rules. He mastered the art of writing legislation that appeared straightforward but contained carefully crafted provisions that expanded his authority. For instance, his manipulation of bridge and tunnel revenues created an independent funding source that made his authorities virtually autonomous from traditional government oversight. He pioneered the use of bond financing for public works, creating a model that would be replicated across the country. Perhaps the most important lesson from Moses' career is that systems matter as much as individuals. The checks and balances that should have constrained Moses failed not just because of his personal qualities, but because of institutional weaknesses. The press that should have scrutinized his projects instead celebrated them uncritically for decades, dazzled by the scale of his vision and the speed of his execution. The legislators who should have overseen his authorities instead deferred to his expertise, intimidated by his mastery of complex details and his reputation for retribution against opponents. The courts that should have protected citizens' rights instead validated his expansive powers, setting precedents that would influence urban development for generations. His relationship with mayors and governors illustrated this dynamic perfectly. While they were technically his superiors, Moses outlasted them all, having built a system where his authorities were so integral to the city's functioning that removing him seemed impossible. He understood that real power lay not in official titles, but in controlling the mechanisms of governance, the authorities, commissions, and boards that actually got things done. As we continue to build and rebuild our cities, Robert Moses reminds us that the question isn't just what we build, but how we decide to build it and who gets to make those decisions. His achievements stand as monuments to human ingenuity and ambition, while his methods serve as warnings about the dangers of power without accountability. The legacy of his approach to urban development, both its successes and failures, continues to influence city planning debates today. From discussions about public transportation priorities to questions of community involvement in major infrastructure projects. In that tension lies the enduring fascination of the power broker, the master builder who reshaped New York, and with it, the modern American city.